Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. I'm your host, Ted Harrington, and with me today is my special guest, Robin Dreek. Robin, welcome to the show.
Ted, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be sharing with you and your audience.
Yeah, totally. So for those of you who don't know who Robin is, he is the man. We'll start with that. So Robin used to be a special agent for the FBI and ran the counterintelligence behavior analysis program there. He's since gone on to be an author and coach and facilitator. And we're going to talk today about some of his work recruiting and training spies and maybe some of the leadership principles we can draw out of that. So how close am I to describing why you're awesome? What did I miss?
I got to make sure share the podcast with my whole family so they can take note of why I'm awesome. No, you didn't miss anything. That was pretty accurate. Matter of fact, when people generally ask me, so man, that must be so cool. You're the chief of the behavioral analysis program for the FBI. How'd you wind up doing that? And the simple answer is I failed at everything I really wanted to do. You know, and those are life's lessons, you know, the humbling moments you learn along the way became my life's work of how not to be the moron that I was born to be.
I love it. So self-deprecating. We're gonna get along well here. So
it's definitely so needed in the world.
I totally agree. Let's dig into this idea of behavioral analysis because our audience here spends their time thinking about one of sort of two ways, and more than these two, I'm way oversimplifying it, but the two that I think that are really interesting in the context of our conversation today are either they're security professionals, and what they're constantly thinking about are things like, well, how does the attacker think? Why do they attack systems in certain ways? How do I defend against them? Or if they're not on the security side, they're more of technologists or on the technology side, and they're more thinking about their users, and they're thinking about, well, I'm building this system. How do I make sure that the people I'm building it for have a great experience with it, et cetera? So maybe could you give us just a brief introduction into what behavioral analysis even is and, you know, how should we be thinking about it in the context of security and or technology?
Absolutely. It's actually the easiest thing to do is to relate it to security because at the heart of everything we do to protect systems, it comes down to human vulnerabilities. You know, I've got a good friend of mine that told me years ago, name's Chris Hagnaghi, he's a social engineer, that I am a social engineer. And I was like, what do you mean? I recruit spies. And he goes, well, you know, how do you do that? And I said, well, you develop trust. And he goes, see, that's social engineering. You know, the most insecure things in the world are human beings and their behaviors. And so, you know, whether it's a phishing mail, spear phishing, you know, or getting in any kind of system information, it always comes down to the human vulnerability. And what it comes down to is the opponent's ability to develop and inspire trust. And so that's where human analysis, behavioral analysis comes in, is what my team did and what I did every day was strategies to inspire trust. Because, you know, you're not going to recruit a spy unless you actually have trust. And from trust, you get a relationship. And the same thing in sales. I call recruiting spies one of the toughest sales jobs in the world because my job was to figure out which one of these individuals had priorities that aligned with mine. And I offer them resources in terms of those priorities. And if one of their priorities was that they didn't want their kids to grow up under the regime that they grew up under, and they want to relocate here, they want, you know, opportunities for their families and their loved ones, well, that's a priority. And I have resources that can help in that priority. And then I share with them what my priorities are, you know, understanding what you're targeting in our infrastructure, you know, our economic well-being, our national security, all these different areas. And so they can then share their knowledge with me. So it comes down to understanding why human beings and how to develop trust.
It's really fascinating. And it's almost interesting to think of trust as something you're almost weaponizing in a certain way, right? Maybe that's overstating it, but the idea that you're saying, you know, trust is often seen as this sort of noble principle that's like, be good, equal trust. And in a sense, you're, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're sort of tapping into that human instinct to want to trust people if certain conditions are met. So first of all, am I understanding what you said correctly, or am I off base there?
Yeah. So, and it's actually, it's funny too, because you can't have trust if there's any suspicion of manipulation, subterfuge, deception. And so I'm actually the counterintelligence guy that'll tell you, I don't lie. I don't strategize manipulation, because anyone that even suspects it, whether it's true or not, you're not going to have trust, no relationship, because everything comes down to the ability to develop strong, healthy relationships. And that's for every aspect of life. And so understanding, you know, so here I always talk about, you know, understanding personality assessment. It's really pretty simple. Human beings were genetically and biologically coded and hardwired to want to belong to meaningful groups and organizations and to be valued by those groups and organizations. Because ancient tribal man, if you weren't part of the tribe, the likelihood of you passing on your genetic coding and your survival was slim to none. And so every time we feel connected to others, every time we feel valued by a group, our brain rewards us with, you know, dopamine, oxytocin and bloodstream, serotonin. The pleasure centers in the brain and body are booming when we feel like we're being valued by others and we feel like we're affiliated. So how do we do that? It's a simple four things I like to do when I'm communicating. And again, using great transparency, openness, and making sure that everything I'm saying is going to develop a strong relationship. And that is, I'm going to be seeking the thoughts and opinions of others instead of sharing mine. I'm going to talk in terms of their priorities, of their needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, personal, professional, long-term, short-term. In other words, what kind of challenges do they have in their lives instead of telling them about mine? Third, I'm going to validate them without judging them. In other words, have this curiosity without judging about understanding the human being, the experience that they had, where they live, the demographic, the ethnicity, the gender, all these things, talk about their context and who they are and not judge it. And finally, give them choices. Because again, we only give people choices if we value them and want to affiliate with them. So if you build one of those four types of statements into everything you say, whether you're live interacting like this or in every statement you write down, the entire shift focuses from yourself onto them. Then that entire conversation becomes about them. And so that's the basis for understanding personality assessment, is doing that, making the conversation about them. And the other thing that's a truism about human beings, besides wanting to be valued and affiliated with others, is we're all very, very predictable. And that comes down to why? Well, we are always going to act in our own best interests in terms of our own safety, security, and prosperity for ourselves and our loved ones. If I take the time to figure out what you think is in your best interest in terms of your safety, security, and prosperity, I now know what you're going to do. So again, these are ways in which to understand another human being and focus outside yourself onto them, and becomes very predictable. And when you do these things, it's trust. It's the beginnings of trust.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And it almost feels like there's an inherent conflict in that. So help me resolve this conflict. Because what I heard you just say was that in order to build trust, you said it more eloquently than this, but ultimately we make it about them, right? So in order for you to trust me, I need to make you know that I care about you and I make the conversation about you. Mm-hmm. So that's what I heard you just say. Yet at the same time, humans are inherently selfish and we always want to talk about ourselves. Yes. So how do we rectify those two things? How does someone who's listening to this and saying, hey, I want to build trust with my boss or with my customer or with my coworker, and they're having these competing feelings, right? One which is, okay, I got to make it about this other person, but I love it about being about me. How does one resolve that conflict?
That comes down to the greatest challenge we all have, and that is ego suspension. You know, we're always self-interested, you know, to make sure that we're going to survive. And so overcoming that self-interest, and you said it at the beginning, you know, using self-deprecating humor, you know, individuals that have the ability to laugh at themselves, know their flaws, are transparent about their flaws. I mean, it's not that you're self self-loathing. It's just you understand yourself well. You understand what the world sees when they see you. Individuals that have a higher level of self-awareness, and they did some great research on this. The book Insight talks about it. You know, they're the most productive and prosperous CEOs and companies in the world are the ones with the higher level of self-awareness. But it takes time. You're right. It's not easy because we are always inherently trying to look after our own best interests first. So this is a fail-safe I try to give myself because, you know, my background, I went to the Naval Academy. From the Naval Academy, went Marine Corps, FBI, served in New York, Norfolk, FBI headquarters. I mean, all these type A hard-charging things, which makes you exceptionally self-centered. You know, I always say, you know, my books I've written are my manuals on how not to be the self-centered narcissist I was born to be. Because what you can do is you start asking yourself the question every time you're faced with a challenge, and your immediate response is to act in your own best interest. Give yourself a pause and ask yourself, is what I'm about to do or say going to help or hinder a healthy relationship with the person I need to be engaging with? And after that, I ask myself, am I going to be having and I need to have open and honest communication and transparency? And the last thing, the last core anchors I anchor myself on is I need to make sure I'm making myself an available resource for their success and prosperity. And here's the key: without expectation or reciprocity. And so you give consciously without that expectation. Now you're sharing what is important to you with others and let them make the choice on whether they want to reciprocate or not. It's the difference between trying to convince people to do something, because convincing is about what I want, as opposed to inspiring them to want to do something, because inspiration has to come from within them. And so it's getting that complete flipping mindset. But yeah, it takes muscle memory and it takes time. It's recognizing opportunities to let go of self and focus on others.
That idea of reciprocity that you bring up is a good one, or giving without the expectation of reciprocity. I was asked this question today, and I'm curious if you've been asked this question throughout your journey of becoming an author. But I was asked this question earlier today, which was, hey, Ted, you know, this book that you wrote literally tells people exactly how to do what companies pay you big bucks to do. Why did you do that? You gave them everything. Why did you do that? And my thinking was, well, there's power in giving. So first of all, I wrote it because I wanted to share the ideas. You know, at some point, the world will pay it back, but the purpose wasn't to make the world pay it back. So how does... how does that land with you in terms of what you were just talking about in terms of reciprocity? Like, are things like that what you're talking about, where someone should do something without the expectation of return, or is it inherently okay to expect the return for something that you do?
So if you, and I completely 100% agree with you, the reason for writing the book, you know, I have a good friend of mine, good teacher, mentor, and guide. His name is Joe Navarro. He wrote the book, What Everybody's Saying, international nonverbal expert, was one of the founders of my behavioral team. And he had a simple philosophy and still does that I adopted. And that is, if you have at least one bit of information another human being could benefit from, shame on you for not getting it to him. You know, and so it's been my mantra. And, you know, if it costs you nothing to give, give. Because it does, you're so right. It's that, you know, thing about paying it forward. I have been dumbfounded by, you know, the reciprocity you get from unexpected places because you pay it forward in some way. If someone needs something, you give it. If someone needs information, you give it. You know, the one thing you learn, you know, as you have too, is, you know, no one can be you. You know, and people are going to hear your words or read your words written differently than you intended them potentially. So some people are going to want to hire you to tell more in depth about what you shared. And some people have got it just from reading the book, and all is good. So I'm all about just, you know, if you have an ability to share, you share. And because, you know, resources, which, you know, can be money, it can be compensation anyway, resources just flow through us. They don't ever end with us. So I have no problem sharing information. You have a company and you need to make money, but at the same time, you know, to have that more altruistic look about being a resource for the success of others without that expectation, it's what it does is it creates that personal brand, and your personal brand is what is with you for your entire life, and that's the personal brand I want to keep.
Oh man, we're so aligned. I love this idea that you just introduced. I'd never quite thought about it the way you just described it, but the idea that, as you call them, resources, the ideas that we have, right, that we've learned and we've figured out how to synthesize them and we can organize them into actionable methods and whatever it is, the fact that that's something that we're just, they pass through us. We just possess it for a moment and it's sort of our job to get it onto someone else. And it's amazing how powerful that idea is, that it's that your idea is very much a multiplier idea, right? Which is like, you're just this custodian for the moment, but can it get to multiple people? So how does an idea like that manifest itself in the spy world? I mean, I we've talked about how you generate trust in order to, you know, recruit these spies. Where does reciprocity and generosity fit into all this?
You know, it's I've never been asked that question quite this, that way before. So, and one of the lines I was going to go down, you know, just talking about this idea of where we actually get our value from life from, you know, that reciprocity is feelings of gratitude that people have from what you do. I mean, I'm sure, I mean, you're on LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn, you know, anytime, you know, I get an impromptu email or a text from someone that is a total stranger that thanks me for a bit of information I gave that changed their life or solved a problem or a challenge, I'll take that any, I mean, that is, those are the best moments of every single day that you see the impact you made on even just one human being out of what you did. And the fact that they took time to give one of the greatest gifts you can give another human being. I think there's two things you can give another human being that are the greatest things. One is non-judgmental validation. And that is seeking to understand them at that deep level without judging it. And the other one is gratitude. You know, it is this most fulfilling thing I think in life is when people have gratitude. I love to give gratitude and I love to get gratitude. And so when someone is giving you gratitude for an action you took, unbeknownst to you even, tell me there's not a better feeling in the world. And so related to world of recruiting spies, you know, recruiting spies, it's a fun, catchy term, but in reality is you're not recruiting anyone. All you're doing is you're trying to identify potential clients, and mine happen to be foreign diplomats that are actually intelligence collection officers for other countries. I'm trying to identify which one of those have priorities that I have resources for. And ultimately, you form very, very strong relationships with these people and their families. You know, they're not necessarily going to know you, but, you know, you're seeing the gratitude that they have for the way you've changed their lives because you took them out of a situation without, you know, hope in a lot of cases, or a dead end, and there's a dying wish of a grandmother or a mother, you know, that their children wouldn't grow up under some horrible regime. And you gave them an opportunity to change their lives for the better. You know, I leave the whole, you know, the espionage side or traitor or something out of that. You know, I look at more on the humanistic side that, you know, people that take actions in what they think is their own best interest, and then they show gratitude for it. That's my reward I've ever gotten. I mean, I've only worked with very, very gracious people that have been very appreciative of the risks that we all took to save lives.
I love that we're talking. I did not anticipate we were going to talk about such beautiful concepts like gratitude and reciprocity.
No one ever expects that from the counterintelligence spy guy, but it's exactly what life is about. You cannot be successful in anything without good, strong, healthy relationships. And because with those, you have partnerships. And everything in life relies upon healthy, strong relationships and partnerships.
Dude, that's powerful stuff. When I was writing my book, it's funny we use the word gratitude in my acknowledgement section. The very first word I use is gratitude. It's like the first sentence is just a one word sentence, just says gratitude. And then I said, you know, my heart is absolutely bursting with it. And my acknowledgement section is, I want to say it's like 5 pages. It gets pretty long because I wanted to thank every single person by name who played a role in the writing of the book. And I actually was reading through that section yesterday and just reading my own words expressing gratitude that, like, I already know these. But just reading it again, it gave me that sort of dopamine hit where I was feeling good because it was, you know, all these people, you know, to varying degrees of their involvement. Some people contributed a huge amount of time, and some people was more of like, you know, some text message exchanges back and forth. And then, you know, most people were somewhere in the middle. But when I was looking at that, to realize a few things. One, humans are selfless and are giving and are willing to help someone else trying to do something big. And two, the expression of that gratitude itself feels really good. And for me, and I'm hoping that when these people get their, when they read their own name in print and they're like, wow, that's cool. I feel recognized. I'm totally in alignment with you on the power of gratitude.
Yeah, because what you just did was you demonstrated their value. And again, that's what we seek and crave. I mean, who doesn't have a great day when someone, you know, you get the, I mean, I still do the old time, you know, thank you cards, you know, thank you notes, you know, because when someone writes a personal note of thanks and gratitude for any action you took, I mean, it's tremendous. I save them. You know, there's something I call the self-motivation notebook. And it's literally, you know, this leather journal, and I haven't written anything in it. I collect any kind word, any, you know, gratitude that's ever been expressed to me that really impacted me. I print it out, I fold it up, I put it in there, because we all have these bad, challenging days from time to time where we feel like garbage, or we feel like we're worthless, or, you know, all those horrible insecurities we have pop up or flare up. Those are the times when you need to take out that book of gratitude and read through it and say, huh, you know, this is just an off day. It's just one. You know, it's not a big not a big deal, because look at all these people that actually have gratitude, and I have gratitude for. You know, it's funny. One of the more common, life's an evolution. It's not a destination, obviously. And so my books are a sequence of all the things I've learned, you know, and continue to learn. And someone asked me, so what's next, you know, after you wrote Sizing People Up? My next thing I'm really focusing on is mentorship, because the power of mentorship, and that's what you described there with your gratitude. All those people in your life, they were your teachers, mentors, and guides that were vested in you and your success. And I made that joke at the beginning about, you know, I got to where I am because I failed at everything else. The areas of my failure came from the times in my life when I did not have a good teacher, mentor, and guide. You know, I went to the Naval Academy to become an aerospace engineer. Well, I failed out of aerospace engineering. And why? I didn't have a good teacher, mentor, and guide to actually help me learn how to study to be an engineer. I wanted to become a naval aviator. Well, I went Marine Corps. Well, because my eyes went bad and I didn't really have, you know, a teacher, mentor, guide. I said I should have gone back and been re-examined a second time, because right now I still have 20/20. You know, and then all these different milestones in life when everyone can reflect, you know, where things went sideways on them, I guarantee you they went sideways because it was that point that you actually lacked a teacher, mentor, and guide, or your own ego and vanity got in the way of you listening to that teacher, mentor, and guide. Because I think it's so important as human beings, we take that relationship, that great healthy relationship we have, you find a teacher, mentor, and guide for the things that it is you're trying to achieve and accomplish and the better person you're trying to be. Then also you have to be a teacher, mentor, and guide for others, because everyone's on a different point on their own path in life. And so teaming up with people and partnering, you know, where you're a teacher, mentor, and guide for others and you have your own, that's where this whole synergistic, you know, relationship comes from. And that's where everyone starts really moving forward at a great, healthy pace, achieving the things that they want to achieve in life.
Yeah, I love that we're talking about mentorship now. I mean, certainly the people who listen to a show like this, they're certainly looking for ways that they can level themselves up, learn new techniques, try to look at problems differently. And mentorship is obviously a very, very powerful way to help have that happen. But here's a problem that I see play out all the time, and maybe you could give some advice on how people might approach this problem. For someone who works in a larger organization or even a small organization, but they're not at the top of the organization, the logical mentor for that person winds up being their manager. Maybe they can seek some other more senior person in maybe another business line. But for most people, it's your boss is your mentor. And so there's a couple problems that come out of it. Number one, not everyone is cut out to be a mentor. And so it's almost luck of the draw who your mentor is, might not actually be the right mentor for you. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is, what about the people who are either at the top of their organization or very, very high in the organization and don't have a superior or a direct manager? And how does that person find mentorship, you know, maybe outside the organization? So in your experience, it sounds like you know a thing or two about mentorship. How should people be thinking about that, seeking mentors, whether that's at a peer level or outside their organization? How should people think?
So I have these different levels of mentorship. You have the ones that are, you know, the ones that you actually have to reach out for, and they'll give you a thought and opinion if you ask a thought and opinion. Then I, you know, you got ones that'll actually offer a thought and opinion unsolicited, and then you have, you know, the highest one that you can really do, and this is where the CEOs come into play, and this is where anyone can really find one of these, and that's the highest level. I call them life's beta testers. And I use beta tester because, you know, when you write a book, you have a beta reader, you know, so these are the people that are vested in your success, but they're objective and they're empathetic towards what it is you're trying to achieve. And so ones that are vested in your success, they're proactive in going out of their way to give ideas, thoughts, and guidance in areas that they know you're trying to pursue. And so for the CEOs and the people at the top of their game, that's why they hire personal coaches, or at least have one hopeful beta tester, someone that might be in their industry and might not be in their industry. And it's the same thing for people at the lower levels. Having your boss as a teacher, mentor, and guide, okay. If it's a good, healthy relationship and that person is non-judgmentally vested in your success, that's a great mentor. But a lot of times we work for people that don't fit that criteria. So for me, identifying a good teacher, mentor, and guide is finding someone that actually is vested in my success and does so proactively. And they're objective when giving me thoughts and opinions, and they also empathetic towards what it is I'm trying to achieve. So they don't ride my emotional roller coaster if I'm having a good day or a bad day, but they're objective, but they actually care deeply about me. And so for finding one, you know, first thing, if you're at the lower level, define what it is you're trying to do, who you want to be, where you want to go, and identify those types of people. And so it might not even be in your own organization, or say you want to rise up in your own organization, but you don't feel that kind of connectivity to ask someone to be a teacher, mentor, and guide above you. Well, that's when you actually find someone outside your organization. It can be even more objective so that they can give advice and guidance on how to rise through the ranks of an organization based on their experiences. You know, I think one of the greatest questions you can ask anyone is like, hey, how did you become who you became? You know, what kind of things did you learn along the way? What some of the challenges? What things would you do again? What advice and guidance do you have for me? What kind of things do I need to put on my resume to achieve this thing? How long do you think it'll basically take me as well? You know, so that way you can manage your expectations on milestones to hit, markers to hit, you know, and then ask their, you know, if they're willing to, you know, bounce ideas off you now and then and seek, you know, and give advice and guidance on moves you're making, you know. So that kind of stuff I think is really good, to identify those types of individuals that are vested and can do so unconditionally.
It kind of seems like these different themes we've been talking about are all sort of intersecting, right?
Yes.
Mentorship is, in a sense, a form of giving and generosity, a form of gratitude even. All of these things kind of help us become bigger and better. How early would you say in a career should someone themselves be thinking about them being a mentor themselves? So let's say someone's their first job out of college. Should they already be thinking about how can they mentor someone else? Or is there an inflection point at which it makes more sense for someone to start thinking like that?
I think what a good thing to do is always be open to it. Is, in other words, you know, I never really thought about this until I started being asked about this more recently, probably in the last year, about, you know, who do I mentor? And I really had to think about that. It's like, who do I mentor? Because I'd never really consciously thought about it. And then when I realized, well, actually, I have my kids, you know, who are young adults in their 20s. I have numerous people that I've become friends with via LinkedIn that are, you know, that are younger seeking advice and guidance. So even when you're just first starting your career, there are people behind you on experience, you know, whether they're just getting out of college, they're just entering college, they're not going to college, they're doing another career track. I mean, there's always people that are a different point in their experiences in life than you. Some are further along and some are further back. And so I always think that being open to that, and when people are seeking help, or they're seeking input, be open to that and give it, because it costs you nothing.
Well, it does cost you time. So I guess maybe that's another challenge for someone as a mentor. And I know that I struggle with this. People hit me up on LinkedIn all the time asking for advice, and I answer all of them. Like, anyone who DMs me and is like, oh, I have advice on this, can you point me in the right direction on that? I will take the time and answer like every complete stranger. But
likewise,
I do also have to always like balance it, right? To say, Well, and maybe this is my own bias, so check me if maybe my bias is in this question. To me, it feels like what I really would like to do is put a lot of energy into a small number of people, and then like a teeny bit of energy into a broader, you know, where people ask questions like that. Is that the right way to think about it, or am I letting my own protection of my time influence me adversely?
No, I think it's a healthy way to do it. I do exactly the same thing. I do my darndest to respond to anyone that reaches out. And the ones that are, it always comes down to tempo. You know, you have control of your own tempo. You have control of how fast you respond, how fast you don't respond. And if someone is trying to push your tempo, and tempo equals time, you know, beyond what you're willing to give a certain, I call these different avenues vectors, you know, what you're, you know, like one vector is correspondence with unknown people. And that's a vector, you know, and you have a certain tempo slash amount of time you can devote to that because you actually have all these other vectors as well that require time and energy. You know, so make sure, you know, for me, I'm making sure I'm controlling the tempo of that one vector. And if someone becomes overly dependent or needy on that vector, remember, you control the rate of response. And so you're still there for them, you're still a resource for them, but you don't have unlimited resources of time. So I always just make sure I control that tempo vector.
Oh, I'm gonna chew on that for sure. That's advice for me. I'm glad that everyone else is listening, but I am glad that I now have gotten that piece of advice.
Well, and what's really funny, and it's a challenge, you know, because, you know, being in an industry where you give the gift of information and knowledge to others, people are going to want that gift and they're going to want more of that gift. And so you want to give it, which is part of your brand. And so I'm with you, you know, responding to as many people, if not everyone you can, is really important because it's part of us and who we are as, you know, sharers of purveyors of knowledge, of taking it in and giving it out. But at the same time, you do have to maintain your own health and sanity.
Totally. So let's pivot a little bit and talk about social engineering, because you certainly understand how people think and how they interact with each other. And so obviously we have a lot of security professionals and technologists listening to our conversation right now. So maybe let's think about it from the perspective of a victim or a potential victim. How should companies and the people that work at those companies be thinking about the way that their adversaries might be coming after them in terms of trying to manipulate them through any form of social engineering, through digital means or through more interpersonal means?
Yeah, so what the malicious hackers are trying to do and the malicious social engineers are trying to do is they're trying to inspire you to take an action that's not in your best interest by getting you to trust an action you're going to take. And so in order to do that, what they're doing is they're using a lot of OSINT, you know, to collect a lot of information. You know, if it's going to be a spearfish coming at you, you know, they're going to do a lot of OSINT for you particularly. And what are they looking for? They're looking to try to identify what your priorities are, what's important to you, your needs, wants, dreams, and aspirations, you know, things that interest you. And so that's what they're going to be using, you know, to come at you. And they're going to be using those four speech principles in their language that they're coming at you with. They're going to be seeking your thoughts and opinions, number one. They're going to be talking in terms of those things that are important to you, and they collected that through their OSINT. They're going to be validating you, in other words, the greatness that you are. And then they're going to do the last thing, which gets people really in trouble. They're going to give you a choice. You know, hey, if you're interested in this, you know, I think you really would be because I see that you're on the cutting edge of your technology in your field. You know, what would you prefer to do? Would you prefer this over here or this over here? Well, both are bad choices because both, you know, click and shell. I mean, so it's what they're doing is they're strategizing how to use those four principles of communication to make that all about you, to get your shields lowered and to inspire you to make a choice. Because when you empower people with choice, they're more likely to do it rather than telling them, hey, you need to click this button here. You need to take this action here. You need to go over here. That's what gets people's shields up. And people say, hey, doesn't really matter to me. I'm good either way. But if you're interested in this thing, you can either do this, or this. And if none of that's good to you, fine. Just click this button here, you know, and report it. Either way, all of it's bad. So they're really just taking a very simple principle of developing trust by making the conversation about them and empowering them with choice. I mean, I remember, you know, Hagnaggy and I on his first course that we did years ago, I think it's my gosh, must have been 10 years ago. He did a lot of spear fishing, not just a whole fish, not just a spear fish, but a fishing in the company. And we modified, I can't remember it exactly, but we modified literally the subject line. We modified two sentences inside the emails, only like a four sentence email. And the click-through ratio went from 35% to 100% because we shifted it from a generic, you know, hey, this, we went from, you know, saying, hey, here's the upcoming schedule of all of our company get together, you know, and that was it. And they're supposed to click on it. But what we did was we said, instead of saying, this is the company schedule of our get together, we said, here's a schedule of our company get together. And this change pertains particularly to you. Click here to see what the change is. And if you think this is a security violation, click here to report it. And with the subject line, we added your updated agenda. So we made it from the generic to the personal, and we used curiosity as a elicitation technique, and click. It was crazy. All the way, two lines.
That's nuts. Even as you're describing it, and I know you're describing an attack, I'm like,
yeah,
which would you click? You know, it sounds so much more engaging. That's that's powerful stuff.
So especially when you spoof it, you know, to the company's email address, it's almost foolproof.
Yeah. And even in, you know, the modern times we live in now, and people are hopefully more aware of these kinds of things than maybe in years past, it's still, there's the way business is done today is still like the fact that we sign contracts because someone sent you a link, right? Like you get the thing from DocuSign and you're like, click here to sign or click here to do something else. And everyone's like, oh, whatever this is, I probably want to sign it because it's like money somehow. And
I get these all the time too. You get non-disclosure agreements that companies are sending you to do work with them. I mean, all these things that are coming in. I mean, I there's nothing more I sweat during the course of a day than when you initiate business with someone and they want to have you DocuSign something or set up ACS, you know, ACH, you know, wire transfers. I mean, that stuff just stresses me out because I know if there was a malicious person on the other end of this. So anytime I do business with anyone, I do so much due diligence to make sure it's legit before I actually engage, just because it's easy to take advantage of people that way.
So how should people think differently about this?
In terms of personal security like that?
Yeah.
I would, you know, form that trust with the individual you're working with first. You know, see how unconditionally invested they are to be working with you, and give it time and do some good OSINT. And most importantly, and this is another great area to have one of those great teacher mentors and guides / beta testers. You know, my wife is one of mine, and she's one of the best ones. So anytime I'm doing new work with any group or organization, her first question is, did you research them? And she gets on and she'll start doing all this objective research, because now I'm as objective as I think I am, because I understand human behavior, I'm vested because I want to do business with someone, because business means it's going to be income / resources. And so I'm going to have my own positive confirmation bias that I want this to be real. I'm the wrong person to be objective now at that point. That's why you have to have someone else in your life giving you that objectivity, so that that way they can do due diligence. And before I take any action, it has to go through her before I click links, before I do anything. It goes through that objective, you know, beta tester to make sure that I'm being safe. So I anytime, again, two people are always better than one when it comes to making decisions like this. So I think that's a good new way to think about it, is if someone wants to come at you and get you and they have mad skills, they're probably going to be able to do it. They've got a high probability of success doing it. The way you avoid it is to not allow them to get over on someone else that is one of your beta testers.
Mm-hmm. Man, it's that's the perfect tee up for me. I feel like I should just hit that softball right out of the park. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book is this idea of how security is a team sport.
Oh, really? And perfect.
There's a whole section about it, and I mean it's a common thread throughout it, and how you know, it is a team sport, and what you really need is that sort of that independence.
Yes.
Because, you know, in any given company, there's bias and there's preconceptions and there's, you know, politically influential members of the company want things done a certain way. And you need that outside entity who can be objective to come in and say, like, look, here's how it is. Even if you don't want to hear this, this is the way that it is. And I mean, that's the principle we've built our entire business around, is you need that independence and that objectivity. But it's really cool to hear you describe it the way that you did with the beta tester model. And
because I mean, it's so, you know, human beings, one of the things I write about, you know, and this is a spin on it, it's exactly the same thing, is we are all subjected to positive or negative confirmation bias. You know, if we like someone, you're going to be hard pressed to find them to find fault with anything they do. And likewise, if you dislike someone, you're going to have a hard time finding anything you like that they do. Confirmation bias is extremely powerful. And that's why having that objective partnership with someone to help you not have it, so you can be objective when making your choices and decisions, is extremely crucial. I mean, law enforcement falls into this all the time. You know, and Hagnaggi and a lot of social engineers really focus on nonverbal behavior with understanding people. And one of the greatest threats to doing good nonverbal body assessment is if you're thinking you're going to find deception indicators. Because now what happens is you think you're going to see deception. So now what do you see? Nothing but deception. You're going to miss all the truth indicators that are coming through, you know. So it's a really scary, powerful thing. That's why, you know, I loved your, you know, what you wrote about, you know, having these partnerships for helping you overcome these confirmation biases is really important.
Totally, man. Well, Robin, you've been a stellar guest. Thank you so much for sharing all the wisdom. I think that people will walk away from this really knowing how to think and do differently. If people want to learn more about some of the ideas that you have, how should they contact you?
Sure. People Formula is my website, peopleformula.com, all one word, peopleformula.com. On there, I've got lots of resources, you know, whether you want to just take a look at some of my videos, you can go to my YouTube channel on there, follow me on Instagram, LinkedIn, all the way up to, you know, my podcast. You know, this will be listed on there as well. And obviously, if you want to scale things up and provide me some resources, there's online training you can take as well. And if nothing else, if you just want to reach out and ask a question, like we were talking about earlier, I am easy to get a hold of if you want to chat me up on LinkedIn or through the website also. But thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, Robin Driek, thank you so much for being on the show. You've been awesome. And I think the world's in a better place with you out there sharing all these ideas. So thank you so much.
Ted, thank you. And the world's a much better place with you in it too, sharing your knowledge. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.